rarely seen in America. When he ordered like the Italians, at first the bartenders asked him, "Normale?" They thought surely a tourist was making a mistake. We require big cups of brown coffee, as the Italians, with a touch of wonder, call it. "Si, si, normale," he answered, with a slight tone of impatience. Soon he was ordering with authority, no one asked again. He saw the locals down it at once instead of sipping. He noticed the brands different bars used, Ely, Lavazza, Sandi, River. He began commenting on the crema on top. Always he took it black. "Your life must be sweet," one barista told him, "to take your coffee so bitter." Then Ed began to notice the sugar boats all the bars have, to notice how when the bartender put down the saucer and spoon, the sugar bowl would be pushed over and opened with a flourish. The Italian shoveled in an incredible amount, 2, 3 mounded spoons. One day I was shocked to see Ed, too, pouring in the sugar. "It makes it almost a dessert," he explained. The second year we visited Italy, he went home at the end of the summer carrying a La Pavone purchased in Florence, a gleaming stainless steel machine with an eagle on top, a hand-operated classic. I was the beneficiary of cappuccino in bed. Here, he also has bought a La Pavone, this one automatic. Before going to bed, he has his final cup of elixir, either at home or in town. There's something he likes about ordering in bars. Sometimes they have curvy deco-era La Faema machines, sometimes chic ranchillos. He examines the crema, swirls the cup once, and gulps it down. It gives him, he says, the strength to sleep. The second major cultural experience he took to with zest is driving. Most travelers here feel that driving in Rome qualifies as an experience that can be added to one's vita, that everyday autostrada trips are examinations in courage, and that the Amalfi Coast Drive is a definition of hell. "These people really know how to drive," I remember him saying, as he swung our no-power rented Fiat into the passing lane, turn signal blinking. A Maserati zooming forward in the rearview mirror blasted us back to the right lane. Soon he was admiring daring maneuvers. "Did you see that? He had two wheels dangling in thin air," he marveled. Sure, they have their share of duffers riding the center lane, but most people keep to the rules. "What rules?" I asked, as someone in a tiny car like ours whizzed by going 100. "Apparently, there are speed limits according to the size of the engine, but I never have seen anyone stop for speeding in all my summers in Italy." He's delighted to read what the mayor of Naples says about driving there. Naples is the most chaotic city for drivers on earth. Ed loved it. He got to drive on the sidewalk while the pedestrians filled the street. The mayor explained, "A green light is a green light. Avanti, avanti. A red light? Just a suggestion." "And yellow?" he was asked. "Yellow is for gaiety." In Tuscany, people are more law-abiding. They may jump the gun, but they do stop for signals. Here the challenge is the medieval streets, with inches to spare on either side of the car, and the sudden turn a bicycle barely could make. The twisted streets lured Ed, and we have backed out of too many when they became impassable, all the locals stopping and staring as we reversed through their town. Most of our trips are on small roads. We've learned not to hesitate to take the unpaved roads if the route looks appealing. Usually they're well-maintained, or at least navigable. We've been known to go off-road to get to an abandoned 13th-century church, and as in the tiny towns, to back up when necessary. No problem to one who has ice water in his veins. To back uphill on a curvy one-lane road is an experience to delight the manic driver. "Whoa," Ed shouts. He's turned around, one hand on the back of my seat, the other on the wheel. I'm looking down, straight down, into a lovely valley far below. There are perhaps 5 inches between the wheel and the edge. We encounter a car coming down. They jump out to confer. Then they, too, begin to back up. Now we are a convoy of idiots. One reason Ed likes the autostrada so much is that he gets to combine his pleasures. Auto grills appear every 30 or so miles. Sometimes they're quick-stop places with a bar and gas. Others arch over the freeway and have a restaurant and shop, even a motel. He appreciates the clean efficiency of the bars. He nips his espresso, often has a quick panino of thick bread and mortadella. I will have a cappuccino, unorthodox in afternoon, and he patiently waits. He never would malinger at the bar. In and out, that's the way it's done. Then back on the road with the fully leaded espresso zinging through him, the speedometer climbing to cruising speed. Paradiso. At a more fundamental level, he has been changed by the land. At first we thought we wanted 20 or 30 acres. 5 seemed small, until we started clearing it of jungle, until we started maintaining it. Limbs fall. New olives must be restaked after storms. The terraces must be plowed, then disked. The olives must be hoed around, fertilized. The grapes still need weeks of attention. In short, we have a little farm here, and we must have a farmer. Without constant work, this place would revert in months to its previous state. We could either feel burdened by this or enjoy it. "How's Johnny Appleseed?" a friend asked. She, too, has seen Ed up on a high terrace examining each plant, fingering the leaves of a new cherry tree, picking up stones. He has come to know every ilex, boulder, stump, and oak. Perhaps it was the clearing that forged the bond. Now he walks the terraces daily. He has taken to wearing shorts, boots, and a muscle shirt, one of those cutaway undershirts my father used to wear. His biceps and chest muscles bulge like after pictures on the backs of old comic books. Although he never remembers to water the houseplants in San Francisco, he hauls buckets up to the new fruit trees in dry spells, babies a special lavender with scented foliage, reads into the night about compost and pruning. How Italian will we ever be? Not very, I'm afraid. Too pale, too unable to gesture as a natural accompaniment to talking. We never will master the art of everyone talking at once. After a soccer game, we'll never gun through the streets blowing the horn or drive a scooter around and around in circles in the piazza. Politics, always, will passeth understanding. Ferragosto at first baffled us as a holiday, until we began to understand it as a state of mind. We gradually have entered this state of mind ourselves. Simply put, Ferragosto, August 15th, marks the ascension of the corporeal body and soul of the Virgin Mary into heaven. Why August 15th? Perhaps it was too hot to remain on earth another day. But the day itself is only a marker in the month, for the broader meaning of the word is August holidays and a period of intense laissez-faire. We're coming to understand that everyday work life is suspended for all of August. Even though throngs of tourists descend on a town, the best trattoria may have tacked up a chiuso per ferie sign, closed for vacation, and the owners have packed and taken off for Viareggio. American business logic does not bear up. They do not necessarily rake in money during tourist season and take their holiday during April or November, when tourists are gone. Why not? Because it is August. All over Italy, the Feast of the Assumption calls for a celebration. Cortona throws a grand party, the Sagra della Bistecca, a festa for the great beefsteaks of the area. Sagra is a wonderful word to look for in Tuscany. Foods coming into season often cause a celebration. All over the small towns, signs go up announcing a sagra for cherries, chestnuts, wine, vinsanto, apricots, frog legs, wild boar, olive oil, or lake trout. Preparations for Cortona's 2-day feast start several days in advance. Town employees construct an enormous grill in the park, a knee-high brick foundation about 6 by 20 feet, and a foot high with iron grills placed over the top, somewhat like the barbecue pits I remember from home. On the same spot, the grill is used later in the year for the town's festa for the autumn porcini. Cortona claims to use the largest frying pan in the world for the mushrooms. I've never been here for that festa, but can imagine the savory aroma of porcini filling the whole park. The men arrange tables for 4, 6, 8, 12 under the trees and decorate with lanterns. Little booths for serving go up near the grill. Then the ticket booth is taken out of a shed, dusted off, and set up at the entrance to the park. Walking through, I glimpse stacks of charcoal in the shed. We decide to walk in over the Roman road. Our neighbor, one of the grill volunteers, waves. Big steaks sizzle over the huge bed of red coals. We join the long line and pick up our crostini, our plates and salad and vegetables. At the grill, our neighbor spears two enormous steaks for us, and we lurch to a table already almost full. Pitchers of wine pass round and round. The whole town comes out for the Sagra, and oddly, there seem to be no tourists here, except for a long table of English people. We don't know the people we're with. They're from Aquaviva. Two couples and three children. The baby girl is gnawing on a bone and looks delighted. The two boys, in the well-behaved way of Italian children, focus on sawing their steaks. The adults toast us, and we toast back. When we say we're Americans, one man wants to know if we know his aunt and uncle in Chicago. After dinner, we walk through town, along with throngs of people. The Rugopiana is jammed. The bars are jammed. We manage to obtain hazelnut ice cream cones. A bunch of teenagers is singing on the steps of the town hall. Three small boys toss firecrackers, then try to look innocent of the act without succeeding. They double over with laughter. On the way home, we pass back through the park. It's almost 10:30, and still the grill is smoking. We see our neighbor dining with his gorgeous wife and daughter and a dozen friends. "How long has the town had this Sagra?" Ed asked them. "Always, always," Placido answers. Scholars think the first commemoration of Mary's feast day was celebrated in Antioch back in 370 A.D. That makes this year's the 1,624th event for her. Old as Cortona is, perhaps killing the white cow and serving it forth in honor of some deity goes back even farther than that. So much more to take home at the end of summer. The Night by Cesare Pavese ends. At times it returns in the motionless calm of the day, that memory of living immersed, absorbed in the stunned light. Green oil. Don't pick today. Too wet. Marco observes us taking down the olive baskets. And the moon's wrong. Wait till Wednesday. He's hanging the doors. Two original chestnut ones he oiled and repaired, and new ones, virtually indistinguishable from the old, that he has made during the fall while we've been gone. They replaced the Holocore doors our great improver in the 50s preferred. We're already late for the olive harvest. All the mills close before Christmas, and we've arrived with a week to spare. Outside, a gray drizzle blurs the intense green grasses that thrived on November rains. I put my hand on the window. Cold. He's right, of course. If we pick today, the wet olives might mildew if we don't finish and get them to the mill. We gather our osier baskets that strap around the waist, so handy for stripping a branch, and the blue sacks the olives are loaded into, the aluminum ladder, our rubber boots. Still jet-lagged and dazed, we're up early, thanks to Marco's arrival at 7:30 when it barely was light. He tells us to go make an appointment at a mill. Maybe it will clear up later. If so, the sun will dry the olives quickly. "What about the moon?" I ask. He just shrugs. He wouldn't pick now, I know. We feel like tumbling back into bed, having had no time since arriving last night to get beyond the 20-hour trip, with storms buffeting the plane most of the way across the ocean. I felt like kissing the ground when we stepped out on the tarmac at Fiumicino. We crazily went into Rome to do a little shopping, then were really beyond thinking as we drove to Cortona in a hilarious rented Twingo, purple with mint-green interior. We hit the autostrada in a bumper car and in a state of exhaustion. Still, the wet and vibrant landscape filled us with elation, that lit from within green, and many trees still twirling colored leaves. When we left in August, it was sere and dry. Now the freshness has reasserted itself. At dark, we finally arrived. In town, we picked up bread and a pan of veal cannelloni. The air felt charged and invigorating. We no longer wanted to collapse. Lara, the young woman who cleans, had turned up the radiators 2 days ago, and the stone walls had time to lose their chill. She even had brought in wood, so on our first night here, we had a little feast by the fire, then wandered from room to room, checking and touching and greeting each object. And so to bed, until Marco aroused us this morning, saying, "Lara said you arrived. I thought you'd want the doors right away." Always, always when we arrive, there is something to haul from A to B. Ed helped him hoist the doors and held them steady while Marco wiggled the hinges onto the metal spurs. The venerable mill at Sant'Angelo uses the purest methods, Marco tells us, cold-pressing each person's olives individually, rather than requiring small growers to double up with someone else. However, you must have at least a quintale, 100 kilograms. Our trees, not yet recovered from 30 years of neglect, may not give us that bounty yet. Many trees have nothing at all. The mill smells thickly oleaginous, and the damp floor feels slippery, possibly oily. Rooms where grapes and olives are pressed have the odors of time as surely as the cool stone smell of churches. The permeating ooze and trickle must move into the workers' pores. The man in charge tells us of several mills that press small batches. We never knew there were so many. All his directions involve turning right at the tallest pine, or left beyond the hump, or right behind the long pig barn. Before we leave, he extols the virtues of the traditional methods, and to prove his point, dips 2 tablespoons into a vat of new oil and hands them to us to taste. It can't be poured onto the floor. There's nothing to do but swallow the whole thing. I can't, but I do. First a tiny taste, and the oil is extraordinary, of a meltingly soft fragrance, an essential, full olive taste. The whole spoon at once, however, is like taking medicine. Splendido, I gulp, and look at Ed, who still hesitates, pretending to appreciate the greeny beauty. What happens to that, I ask, gesturing to troughs of pulp. Our host turns, and Ed quickly slips his oil back in the vat, then tastes what's left on the spoon. Favoloso, Ed says to him, and it is. After the first cold pressing, the pulp is sent on to another mill and pressed again for regular oils, then pressed last for lubricating oils. The dried-out remains in a wonderful cycle of return, often are used to fertilize olive trees. Ed swings the car out onto what once was a Roman road. Later, it led pilgrims on their way to the Holy Land. Perhaps the pilgrims rubbed oil into their weary feet. We, however, are just searching for a mill that will transform our sacks of black olives into bottles of oil. 2 of the mills already have closed. At the third, a woman in about 6 layers of sweaters comes down her steps and tells us we're too late, the olives should have been picked, and now the moon is wrong. Yes, we tell her, we know. Her husband has closed his mill for the season. She points down the road at a grand stone villa we turn in. A discreet sign, Il Mulino, directs us to the rear, but when we drive around, 2 workers are hosing off their equipment. Too late. They direct us to the large mill near town. Whizzing along, I look at the winter gardens. Everyone's growing pale, stalky cardoons, called gobi in the local dialect, and green-black cavolo nero, black cabbage, which grows not in a head, but in upright plumes. Red and green radicchio star in every garden. Most have artichoke plants. Until winter, I never knew there were so many persimmon trees, with the lacquered orange fruit dangling in bare limbs. The trees look composed of quick brush strokes, like Japanese drawings of themselves. At the mill, everyone is so busy that we're ignored. We walk around watching the process and aren't drawn to having our precious olives pressed here. It's all quite mechanized looking. Where are the big stone wheels? We can't really tell if they use heat, a process that supposedly damages the taste. We watch a customer come in, have his fruit weighed, then see it dumped into a large cart. Maybe the olives are all the same and mixing doesn't matter, but somehow this time we would love to have the pleasure of oil from the land we've worked on. We exit quickly and drive to our last hope, a small mill near Castiglione Fiorentino. Outside the door, three huge stone wheels lean against the building. Just inside, wooden bins of olives are stacked, each one with a name on it. Yes, they can press ours. We're to come back tomorrow. The afternoon warms and clears. Marco gives us the okay to begin. Moon or no, we start picking. It's fast. We empty our baskets into the laundry basket, and as that fills, pour the olives into the sack. Few have fallen, though they yield easily to our fingers. A strong wind could cause a lot of damage, unless one had spread nets under the trees. The shiny black olives are plump and firm. Curious about the raw olive, I bite one and it tastes like an alum stick. How did anyone ever figure out how to cure them? The same people, no doubt, who first had the nerve to taste oysters. Ligurians used to cure olives by hanging bags in the sea. Inland people smoked them over the winter in their chimneys, something I'd like to try. We peel off jackets, then sweaters as we work, hanging them in the trees. The temperature has climbed to about 55 degrees, and although our boots are wet, the air feels balmy. Off in the distance we see the blue swath of Lake Trasimeno under an intense blue sky. By 3, we have stripped every single olive off 12 trees. I put my sweater on again. Days are short here in winter, and already the sun is headed for the rim of the hill behind the house. By 4, our red fingers are stiff and we quit, hauling the sack and basket down the terraces into the cantina. Not for the first time in our history here, my body is jarred into awareness. Today, shoulders. Nothing would be nicer than a long soak in a bubble bath and a massage. I have left my body oil to warm on the radiator in anticipation. But with only 20 days here, every minute counts. We force ourselves to go into town to stock up on food. My daughter and her boyfriend, Jess, arrive in 3 days. We're planning several major feasts. We drive in just as the stores are reopening after siesta. Strange, it's already dark as the town comes back to life. Swags of white lights strung across the narrow streets swing in the wind. The A&O market where we shop has a rather ratty artificial tree outside, the only tree in town, and big baskets of gift foods inside. From our brief Christmas visit last year, we know that the focus of the season is twofold, food and the presepio, the creche. We're ready to launch into one and are intrigued by the other. The bars display fancy candies and panettone, that lighter Italian parallel to our ubiquitous Christmas fruitcake. A few shops have distinctly homemade wreaths. That's it for decoration, except for the creches in all the churches and in many windows. Auguri, auguri, everyone says. Best wishes. No one is rushing about. There seems to be no gift wrap, no hype, no frantic search. The window of the Frutta e Verdura is steamed. Outside, where we're used to seeing the fruits of summer, we find baskets of walnuts, chestnuts, and fragrant clementines, those tiny tangerines without seeds. Maria Rita, inside in a big black sweater, is cracking almonds. Ah, benissimo, she greets us. Bentornato. Where there were luscious tomatoes, she has piled stacks of cardi, which I've never tasted. You boil it, but first you must take off all the strings. She cracks a stalk and peels back the celery-like filaments. Throw it in some lemon water quickly or it will turn black. Then boil. Now it's ready for the Parmigiano, the butter. How much? Oh, enough, enough, signora. Then the oven. Soon she's telling us to make bruschetta on the grill in the fireplace and pile on it chopped black cabbage cooked with garlic and oil in a frying pan. We buy blood oranges and tiny green lentils from a jar, chestnuts, winter pears, whiny little apples, and broccoli, which I've never seen in Italy before. Lentils for the New Year, she tells us. I always add mint. She piles in our bags all the ingredients for ribollita, the wintry soup. At the butcher's, new sausages are in, looped along the front of the meat case. A man with a sausage-shaped nose himself elbows Ed and acts out saying the rosary, then points to the long links of fat sausages. It takes us a moment to make the connection, which he thinks is very funny. Quail and several birds that look as though they should be singing in a tree lie still in their feathers in the case. Color photos on the wall show the butcher's name written on the backsides of several enormous white cows, source of the Valdichiana steak that Tuscany celebrates. There's Bruno with his hand possessively around the neck of a great beast. He motions for us to follow him. He opens the freezer room. A cow the size of an elephant hangs from ceiling hooks. Bruno slaps the flank affectionately. The finest bisteca in the world. A hot grill, rosemary, and a little lemon at the table. He turns up both hands, a gesture that adds, "What else is there in life?" Suddenly the door slams shut and we are locked inside with this massive body encased in white fat. Oh, no! I flash on the three of us, caught, as in the child's game of freeze. I swing around toward the door, but Bruno is laughing. He easily opens the door and we rush out. I don't want any steak. We intended to cook, but we have lingered. We deposit all the food in the car and walk back to Dardano, our favorite trattoria, for dinner. The son who has waited tables since we came here suddenly looks like a teenager. The whole family sits around a table in the kitchen. Only two other customers are here, local men bent over their bowls of penne, each eating as though he were alone. We order pasta with black truffles, a carafe of wine. Afterward, we walk around in the quiet, quiet streets. A few boys play soccer in the empty piazza. Their shouts ring in the cold air. The outdoor tables are stored, the bar doors closed tight, with everyone inside breathing smoke. No cars, a lone dog on a walk. Totally emptied of foreigners except us, the town reveals its silences, the long nights when men play cards way past the 9 o'clock bells, the deserted streets that look returned to their medieval origins. At the Duomo wall, we look out over the lights of the valley. A few other people lean on the wall, too. When we're really freezing, we walk back up the street and open the bar door to a burst of noise. The cocoa, steamed on the espresso machine, is thick as pudding. One day back, and I'm falling in love with winter. At first light, we are out on the terraces, even though heavy dew is on the olives. We intend to finish today, not leaving them time to mildew. Below us, the valley surges with fog, as thick as mascarpone. We are above it in clear, frosty air, utterly fresh and sharp to inhale, as if we're looking down from a plane, a disembodied feeling. This hillside is floating. Even the red roof of our neighbor Placido's house has disappeared. The lake gives this landscape some of its mystery. Large mists rise off the water and spread over the valley. Fog billows and rises. As we pick olives, wisps of clouds pass us. Soon the sun asserts itself and begins to burn off the fog, showing us first the white horse in Placido's pen, then his roof, and the olive terrace is below him. The lake stays hidden in a pearly swirl of clouds. We come to trees with nothing on them, then a laden tree. I take the lower branches. Ed leans the ladder into the center and reaches up. To our joy, Francesco Falco, our caretaker of the olives, joins us. He's the quintessential olive picker in his rough wool pants and tweed cap, basket strapped to his waist. He sets to work like the pro he is, picking more than we're able to. He's not as careful, just lets twigs and leaves fall in, whereas we've fastidiously removed any stray leaf after reading they add tannin to the taste of oil. Now and then he pulls out his machete from the back of his pants. How does he not get poked in the bottom? And hacks off a sucker sprouting up. We must get the olives in, he tells us. A big freeze may be coming. We pause for a coffee, but he keeps picking. All fall he has cut back the dead wood. By spring he will have hacked off everything except the most promising limbs. We ask about bush olives, more experimental techniques of pruning we've read about, but he will hear nothing of those. The way to take care of olives is second nature, unquestionable. At 75, he has the stamina of someone half his age, the same stamina, I suppose, that gave him the strength to walk home to Italy from Russia at the end of World War II. We identify him so totally with the land around Cortona that it's hard to imagine him as the young soldier stranded thousands of miles from home when the ugly war ended. He jokes constantly, but today he's left his teeth at home, and we have a hard time understanding him. Soon he heads for the lower terraces, an area still overgrown, because he has seen from the road that some of the olives there are bearing fruit. With the olives from below, we do have a quintale. After siesta, which we worked through, we hear Francesco and his friend Beppe coming up the road on a tractor, pulling a cart of olives. They've taken the sacks of their friend Gino and are on their way to the mill. They load Gino's olives into Beppe's ape and help us load ours on, too. We follow them. It's almost dark and the temperature is dropping. Many California winters have dimmed my memory of real cold. My toes are numb, and the Twingo heater is sending out a forlorn stream of tepid air. It's only about 25 degrees, Ed says. He seems to radiate warmth. His Minnesota background reawakens any time I complain that I'm cold. Feels like Bruno's freezer to me, I say. Our sacks are weighed, then the olives are poured into a bin, washed, then crushed by 3 stone wheels. Once mashed, they're routed to a machine that spreads them on a round hemp mat, stacks on another mat, spreads more until there is a 5-foot stack of hemp circles with the crushed olive sandwiched between each. A weight presses out the oil, which oozes down the sides of the hemp into a tank. The oil then goes through a centrifuge to get all the water out. Our oil, poured into a demijohn, is green and cloudy. The yield, the mill owner tells us, was quite high. Our trees have given us 18.6 kilograms of oil from our quintale, about a liter for each fully bearing tree. No wonder oil is expensive. What about the acid, I ask? I've read that oil must have less than 1% of oleic acid to qualify as extra virgin. 1%? He grinds his cigarette under his heel. Signore, più basso, basso, he growls. Lower, lower, insulted that his mill would tolerate any inferior oil. These hills are the best in Italy. At home we pour a little into a bowl and dip in pieces of bread, as people all over Tuscany must be doing. Our oil I've never tasted better. There's a hint of a watercress taste, faintly peppery, but fresh as the stream watercress is pulled from. With this oil I'll make every bruschetta known, and some as yet unknown. Perhaps I'll even learn to eat my oranges with oil and salt, as I've seen the priests do. The sediment will settle in the big container over time, but we like the murky, fruity oil, too. We fill several pretty bottles I've saved for this moment, then store the rest in the semi-darkness of the cantina. Our herbs still thrive, despite the cold. I cut a handful of sage and rosemary sprigs, quarter onions and potatoes, and arrange them around a pork roast, and pop it in the oven. After a liberal sprinkling of our first season's oil baptizes the pan. The next afternoon, we find an olive oil tasting in progress, the town's first festa for the extra virgin oil of the Cortona Hills. I remember my tablespoon at the Mulino, but this time, this bread from the local bakery. 9 growers' oils are lined up along a table in the piazza, with pots of olive trees around for ambience. I couldn't have imagined this, could you? Ed asked me as we try the 4th or 5th oil. I couldn't. The oils, like ours, are profoundly fresh, with a vigorous element to the taste that makes me want to smack my lips. The shades of difference among the oils are subtle. I think I taste that hot wind of the summer in one, the first rain of autumn in another, then the history of a Roman road, sunlight on leaves. They taste green and full of life. Floating World, a winter season. There's something as inevitable as labor that takes over around Christmas. I feel impelled to the kitchen. I feel deep hungers for star-shaped cookies and tangerine ices and caramel cakes, things I never think of during the rest of the year. Even when I have vowed to keep it simple, I have found myself making the deadly Martha Washington jetties my mother made every year on the cold back porch. You have to make them in the coal because the sinful cream, sugar, and pecan fondant balls are dipped by toothpick into chocolate and held up to set before being placed on the chilled wax paper tray. The chocolate dip, of course, constantly turns hard and must be taken into the kitchen and heated. My mother made jetties endlessly because her friends expected them. We professed to find them too rich, but ate them until our teeth ached. The other absolute was roasted pecans, nuts roasted in butter and salt. The arteries tense, even to say this. We ate them by the pound. I cannot get through a Christmas without them, although now I usually give most to friends and save only a small 10 for the house, for guests, of course. This year, no jetties, but our almond crop must be used, so roasted almonds seem inevitable. In preparation for Ashley and Jess's arrival, I'm making the big pot of ribollita, a soup for ending a day of field work, or, as I think of it, for arriving from New York. Reboiled is the unappetizing translation, and naturally it is, like so many peasant dishes, a soup of necessity, beans, vegetables, and hunks of bread. Winter food makes me understand Tuscan cooking at a deeper level. French cooking, my first love, seems light years away, the evolution of a bourgeois tradition as opposed to the evolution of a peasant tradition. Tortelloni and brodo, a Christmas tradition here, seems like a sophisticated concept. 3 half-moons of stuffed pasta steaming in a bowl of clear broth. But really, what is more frugal than to combine a few leftover tortelloni with extra broth? More than pasta, bread is the basic ingredient of the repertoire. Bread soups, bread salads, which seem rich and imaginative in California restaurants, were simply someone's good use of leftovers, possibly when there was little in the house except a little stock or oil to work with. The clearest example of the poor kitchen must be aquacotta, cooked water, probably a cousin of stone soup. This varies all over Tuscany, but always involves invention around a base of water and bread. Fortunately, wild edibles always abound along the roadsides, a handful of mint, mushrooms, a little sweet burnet, or various greens might flavor cooked water. If an egg was handy, it was broken into the soup at the last moment. That Tuscan cooking has remained so simple is a long tribute to the abilities of those peasant women who cook so well that no one, even now, wants to veer into new directions. Ashley and Jess arrive within an hour of each other, a miracle of scheduling, since she is coming to Chiusi from the Rome train and he is coming into Camuccia from Pisa and Florence after landing from London. We pick her up, then speed the 40 minutes back and arrive just as he steps off the train. The people one's children bring home are problematic. One came to visit when we were renting a house in the Mugello, north of Florence. He was deeply into Thomas Wolfe and sat in the back seat engrossed in Look Homeward, Angel. We madly drove all over Tuscany to show them, both artists, the Piero della Francescas, but he only turned pages and sighed now and then. Once he looked up and saw the round gold bales of hay in the lovely fields and said, "Cool, those look like Richard Serra sculptures." We never were sure anything else penetrated. Another never paid me for his round-trip New York-Rome ticket, which was charged to my Amex because Ashley picked up their tickets. Naturally, we have been wondering about the person who will be spending a couple of weeks. If I'd had a boy, I'd have wanted him to be like Jess. We both fall right away for his humor, curiosity, and warmth. He arrives with a wicker hamper of smoked salmon, Stilton, oat biscuits, honey, and jams. He spent his last 2 days in London buying beautifully wrapped gifts for everyone. Best of all, we don't seem like capital P parents to him, but potential friends. Relieved that this will be effortless, I'm buoyed, too, by that expansion I feel when someone new is admitted into my life. My Iranian friend maintains that attractions among people are based on smell, which seems logical enough to me. Most of those most important to me I've liked instantaneously and have known I wanted a permanent friendship. The times the connection has not lasted still sting. Jess knows all the words to every rock song. Ashley is laughing. We're already singing in the car. What luck! It's midday and too warm for Ribolita. We stop in town and have sandwiches at a bar. Ashley has had a long trip and wants to fade. Ed and I take a walk, then, because the day is warm and the force of habit strong, we start to work in the garden. I pull weeds away from the herbs and lift geraniums out of the pots, shake off dirt from the roots, and wrap them in newspaper to store over the winter. Ed mows the long grass and rakes. Everything is drenched, sweet, lush. Even the weeds are beautiful. I decorate the shrine with boughs of spruce and its nuts, olive branches, and a gold star over Mary's head. Ed tries to burn a pile of leaves we never were able to burn last summer because of the dryness. They're so wet now that they just smoke. When Ashley and Jess reappear, we drive to the nursery and buy a living tree and a big pot to plant it in. Small as it is, it dominates the living room. Since we have nothing for decoration except a string of white lights, we decide to go to Florence tomorrow and buy a few ornaments. I've brought over some candles shaped like stars and some distinctly non-Tuscan farolitos, a Santa Fe custom I've kept since spending a Christmas there once and loving the candles in paper bags outlining the adobe houses. These are glazed bags with cut-out stars. We line the front stone wall with a dozen of them, and they look magical with their glowing stars. We fill the fireplace overhang with pine cones and branches of cypress Ed cut this afternoon. How easy everything seems, and what a pleasure to recover the fun of Christmas. The bowls of Ribolita and a fire act as knockout drops. In the big armchairs, we're wrapped in mohair blankets, listening to Elvis sing Blue, Blue, Blue Christmas on the CD. At the outdoor market in Florence, we find papier-mâché balls and bells with decoupage angels. A wagon off to the side serves bowls of tripa, tripe, a special love of the Florentines. Business looks brisk. If I thought yesterday that I was falling in love with winter, today it's certain. Florence is redeemed and magnificent on a cold December morning. As in all the towns, the decorations are sweet, lights strung across the narrow streets at short intervals, necklaces of light with dangling pendants. Obviously, the women of this city have not heard of cruelty to wildlife and never have seen so many long, lavish fur coats. We look in vain for fake fur. The men are dressed in fine wool overcoats and elegant scarves. My favorite bar is crowded with noisy voices and clinks of cups and constant rushes of steam from the espresso machine. In the middle of the street, Ed pauses and holds up his hands. Listen. What is it? We all stop. Nothing. How could we not have noticed? No motorcycles. It must be too cold for them. Ashley wants boots for Christmas. Obviously, this is the place. She finds black boots and brown suede ones. I see a black bag I really admire, don't need, and manage to resist. Just before everything closes, we dash over to San Marco. The serene monastery with Fra Angelico frescoes in the cells. Jess never has seen it, and the 12 angel musicians seem good to look at during this season. Siesta catches up with us, so we settle into a long lunch at Antolino's, a righteous trattoria, with a pot-bellied stove in the middle of the room. The menu lists pasta with hare and boar ragu, duck, polentas, and risottos. The waiters rush by with platters of big roasts. There's plenty of time to go for a long walk before the town reopens. Florence, the tourists are gone, or if they're here, the fine misty rain must keep them inside. We pass the apartment we rented 5 years ago when I swore off Florence. In summer, wads of tourists clog the city as if it's a Renaissance theme park. Everyone seems to be eating. That year, a garbage strike persisted for over a week, and I began to have thoughts of plague when I passed heaps of rot spilling out of bins. I was amazed that long July when waiters and shopkeepers remained as nice as they did, given what they had to put up with. Everywhere I stepped, I was in the way. Humanity seemed ugly, the international young in torn T-shirts and backpacks, lounging on steps, bewildered bus tourists dropping ice cream napkins in the street and asking, "How much is that in dollars?" I saw my own reflection in the window, carrying home all my shoe purchases, the sundress not so flattering. Bad wonderland. Henry James in Florence referred to one's detested fellow pilgrim. Yes, indeed, and it's definitely time to leave when one's own reflection is included. Sad that our century has added no glory to Florence, only mobs and lead hanging in the air. Today, however, the stony streets take a shine from the mist. We walk right in the Brancacci Chapel. No line, in fact, only a half dozen young priests in long black gowns, following an older priest as he points and lectures about the Masaccio frescoes. I haven't seen Adam and Eve leaving Eden since the vines over their genitals, painted during some fit of papal modesty, were removed and the frescoes cleaned and restored. Shocking to see them lifted out of the film of centuries of candle smoke. All these distinct faces and the chalky rose and saffron robes. Every face, isolated and examined, reveals character. I wanted to see what made each one that one, Gertrude Stein said about her desire to write about many lives. A neophyte kneels in a stream to be baptized. Through the transparent water, we see his knees and feet. San Pietro flings the basin, showering his head and back with water. Another pleasure is Masaccio's attention to architecture, light, and shadow. Here's Florence as he saw or idealized it, with the sun falling logically on this cast of characters who surely walked the streets of this city. We hurry to the 619 train and miss it. As we wait, I mention the black bag I didn't buy, and Ed decides it would be a terrific Christmas present, although we have said we are only buying things for the house. He and Jess literally run back to the shop halfway across town from the train station. Ashley and I are uneasy when it's 5 minutes until departure, but here they come, smiling and panting, waving the shopping bag just as the train is announced. On Christmas Eve, we take off on a quest in Umbria. Ed thinks we must have one of his favorite reds for Christmas dinner, the Sagrantino, impossible to find this far from its origins. I am after the ultimate panettone, which is sold at a shop called Ceccarani in Perugia, so we are off. Ceccarani's window display is a full creche, intricately executed in glazed bread dough. Dough must be a good medium. The figures have expressive faces. Sheep look woolly. Bronze on the palm trees are finely detailed. The nativity scene is surrounded by marzipan mushrooms and panettone hollowed out on the side. Inside each, what else but a miniature creche? Incredible! Throngs of women fill the shop. I push to the back and select a panettone as tall as a top hat. Deeper into Umbria, we come to Spalo and walk all over the steeply terraced town. Coming down from Spalo, we see the early moon hoisting itself over the hills. We keep losing it as we turn, then face it again, the largest, whitest, spookiest moon I've ever seen. All the way to Montefalco, home of the Sagrantino, we dodge the moon. Two or three times we see it rise again, over a different hill. Jess has taken to calling Ed Montefalco for his black leather jacket and tendency to speed. He makes up Montefalco adventures as we take several wrong turns. In the piazza, the wine store is open, but the proprietor is missing. We look around, look outside, come back. No sign of him. We take a walk around the piazza. The store stands wide open, but still the owner is gone. Finally, we ask at the bar, and the bartender points out a man playing cards. We buy our four bottles and head home, chasing the moon across Umbria. On Christmas Eve, Ashley and I launch into cooking. Jess, a novice, is given tasks and entertains us with rock lyrics. Ed dedicates the morning to squeezing silicone around the windows. He runs into town to pick up tonight's first course, crispelli from the fresh pasta shop. The delicate crepes are filled with truffles and cream. Our menu after the crispelli, a warm salad of porcini, roasted red peppers and field lettuces, grilled veal chops, the local cardoons with bechamel and toasted hazelnuts. For dessert, a family cake I know by heart, and castagnaccio, the classic Tuscan chestnut flour cake. My neighbor says not to try it. Her grandmother used to make it when they were very poor. All it takes is chestnut flour, olive oil, and water, she says. My grandmother said that they always had those. They flavored it with rosemary and some pine nuts, fennel seeds and raisins if they had some. This recipe is decidedly weird. As my neighbor indicates, it must be one of those acquired tastes. But where are the sugar and eggs? Can this really turn into a cake? And how much water to use? The recipe only says to use enough for the batter to pour easily. My neighbor just shakes her head. I'm intrigued. This cake will take us back to the roots of Tuscan cooking. Ashley and Jess are not so sure they want to be transported that far. Before siesta, we walk over the Roman road into town for last-minute lettuces and bread. Where is our angel? In winter, he does not seem to come to the shrine. I watch for his slow approach, his eyes on the house, then his long pause while he places his flowers. Would he bring a twig of bright rose hips, a shriveled bunch of dried grapes, a spiny chestnut casing split to reveal three brown nuts? Perhaps he walks elsewhere in winter, or stays in his medieval apartment, feeding logs into the wood stove. Cortona is hopping. Everyone carries at least one panettone and one basket of cellophane-wrapped gift foods. No shop plays that canned, generic Christmas music I find so dispiriting at home. People crowd the bars, stoking themselves with coffee and hot chocolate, because the sharp tramontana has started to blow in from the north, bringing frigid air from the Alps and northern Apennines. Peaceful eve, bountiful feast, dessert by the fire. We all hate the chestnut cake. Flat and gummy, it probably has the exact taste of a Christmas dessert during the last war, when chestnuts could be foraged in the forest. We trade it for a platter of walnuts, winter pears, and gorgonzola, a dessert for the gods. Long before midnight mass, which we'd hoped to experience in one of the small churches, we fade. Ed calls up from downstairs. Look out the window. Snow fell in the night, just enough to dust the fronds of the palm tree and glaze the terraces with a sheen of white. Beautiful. Turn up the heat. My bare feet feel icy. I pull on a sweatshirt, jeans, and shoes and run downstairs. The front doors are wide open, the frosty light pouring in. Ed scrapes a snowball off the outdoor table. I jump aside and it lands in the hall. The sleeping beauties have not yet emerged. We take our coffee to the stone wall, brush it off, and watch the fog below us moving like an opalescent sea. Snow on Christmas. Is this much happiness allowed? I secretly ask myself. Will the gods not come down and confiscate this health, abundance of cheer, these bright expectations? Is this the old scar, this rippling of want and fear? My father died on the eve of Christmas Eve, when I was 14. The funeral day was rainy, so rainy that the coffin floated for a moment before it settled into the earth. My pink tulle Christmas dance dress hung on the back of my closet door. Or is this unrest just part of the great collective holiday blues all the newspapers focus on every year? Many Christmases in my adult life have been exquisite, especially when my daughter was a child. A few have been lonely. One was very rocky. Either way, the season of joy comes with a primitive urge that runs deep into the psyche. After breakfast, we build up the fire and open presents. We brought over a few and slowly have accumulated the usual pile around the tree. We hadn't intended to have so many, but the day in Florence inspired us to pick out soaps, notebooks, sweaters, and a surprisingly huge quantity of chocolate. One of our gifts is a chestnut roasting pan, which we put to immediate use. We're gathering at 4 at Fenella and Peter's, and one of our contributions will be roasted chestnuts in red wine. We cut a thin slit on each, shake them over the coals for less than 10 minutes, then prepare to ruin our nails peeling them. Perhaps because they are fresh, the shells come right off, revealing the plump, toasted nut. Everyone takes a job, and we fly through the preparation of 2 faraone, guinea hens, and a rustic apple tart made by rolling a large round of pastry on a cookie sheet, piling the buttered and sugared fruit and toasted hazelnuts in the center, then flapping the pastry irregularly around it. Our cook, Willie Bell, would be proud of my variation on her cream gravy. To the faraone pan juices I add bechamel and chopped roasted chestnuts. I want chestnuts in everything. Fenella is preparing a pork roast and polenta. Elizabeth will bring salad, and Max is in charge of another vegetable and dessert. We could fast before such a feast, but we have a light lunch of wild mushroom lasagna. A Christmas walk is a long tradition, for Ashley and me at least. Ed and I haven't told them yet where we are going. We drive to the end of a road near our house and get out. We discovered this walk purely by chance one day when we walked this road and spotted a path at the end of it. We kept walking and made a fantastic discovery. It was one of the great walks I've ever had, and we decided then to come back at Christmas. Water is flowing where I've never seen it in the summer. Sudden streams gush out of crevices and wash over the road. We come to a waterfall and several torrents. Soon we're in a chestnut and pine forest of huge ancient trees. We see a few patches of snow in the woods, and more snow higher up in the distance. The air, deeply moist, smells of wet pine needles. We come to paving stones laid in.